from that point on, we could make Grignards pretty well. This improvised bomb, we wound heaters around it so we could just distill things out of it. Then we stirred it from a drill press at the top. And my friend John Spire down the street still has that drill press in his basement.
Really?
Yes.
Was Corning aware of this work? Were you in touch
with Corning? We got started on it in January of 38, and by April of 38, Mr. Macbeth, who had been the Macbeth of the Macbeth Evans Company, in fact, I think he was one of the reasons they bought Macbeth Evans, because he was a fine financial man, was going back to Corning one time, and McGregor was on the same train, and he said, you know, I think they're doing something the same way up there with Frank Hyde that you're doing. You better get in touch with somebody. So lo and behold, we did make arrangements to meet with Frank Hyde in April of 38, and sure enough, we were doing pretty much the same things. And at that point, we drew up a long agenda for the two groups and pretty much divided the field, in a sense, in that he was working already in the aromatic field and we had been working in the aliphatic field. So we kept on working in the aliphatic field and he kept on working in the aromatic field. And this is about the way it continued for quite some time. We finally got a pilot plant in 1940. We had shown by that time that dimethyl was the thing that we wanted to make. We'd made some dimethyl fluids and shown their interesting properties. And lots of people wanted to try them, but we could only make, you know, a pound at a time. So Corning decided to support at least 1 year of a pilot plant. And for $6,000, this is amazing, for $6,000 they got the equipment and the man and the supplies and the overhead for Mellon Institute. They spent $1,500 on the equipment, and his salary was $1,500 for the year, and supplies were a little, and the 10% of the $600 was overhead for the Mellon Institute. So that's all that went into that first year. It's a little hard to believe anymore, considering today's dollar values, but nonetheless, that was... So we put up a 15-gallon... kettle that was able to take pressure about 150 pounds, and a small column about 10 feet high packed with carbon rings and receivers and so on. And from that point on, we made quite a lot of dimethyl fluid and ran it. Well, at one point, Corning said, would we make some phenyl ethyl, which is what Frank Hyde had been making for his resin work. Well, we bought some additional equipment from the Rubber Reserve Fellowship as they began to phase out of their work. And it was a big 100-gallon kettle that didn't have a jacket on it, so it was an unjacketed kettle. So we were going to have trouble. We'd just react to things in it. And we did try it. I can remember helping Ed Meese, who was our chem engineer, pilot plant man. We made the original Grignard in the kettle and then pumped it up into another 55-gallon drum above the kettle. However, the Grignard we made was an etherless Grignard of phenyl Grignard in xylene, which is not a normal Grignard, but it will run. It was a Dow chemical patent that we were following. got it up there. However, as it began to cool, the darn stuff thickened, and we couldn't drip it back into the kettle. So here we were, and it was Christmas Eve. And Ed Meese and I were ladling this damn stuff. You talk about ladling it out in the open air and just dripping it into the kettle. And we did finally get it all in. Because the kettle had silicon tet in it now, and we were trying to put fennel greenyard on it. Well, it soon developed that Mellon Institute was not the place to run moderate scale reactions. We got away with our first work because it was done without using chlorides. But when you start to use chlorides, well, we had to filter out the salts and all, of course, and the filter press leaked, and here, in order to stop the choking from the HCl that was around, we put out great big beakers full of ammonia. Well, of course, that only accentuated it, but now we had ammonium chloride in the air. So it was a mess. And we decided Mellon Institute was not the place to conduct this experiment. And Frank Hyde had suggested to Corning, I guess, that why didn't they contact Dow Chemical, because they had the engineering know-how to make this thing go. So this was about summer of 42 when contact was made with Dow Chemical, and they began to work more or less right away. Dr. E.C. Britton was the man who was put in charge to begin with, and he wrote to us and asked for the directions for our etherless grignard. And he did some work on that, although he did most of the work on Frank's regular grignards, which were phenyl and ethyl to put on silicon to make a phenyl ethyl material, which later was resinified to make a resin, which was the one that ultimately went onto motors for the Navy. Well, all behind the scenes, things had been going on in Corning, of course. Corning didn't know what to do with this kind of field because it was organic, and they had been in the inorganic field all their lives. And so at one point, the manager, Frank Hyde, had worked for the so-called fiberglass division of Corning. This was before Owens Corning Fiberglass was formed. And a man by the name of Morrow was head of that. And he invited General Electric to come down and see what Frank had done. So Frank didn't know any different. He told him exactly what he'd done. I think Morrow and maybe some of the others at Corning had the idea that GE, being interested in resins, might say, well, why don't we get together and work on this? No, they just took the information back home and started immediately to work on it. They put a man by the name of Rockow on it, and of course that we got into interference later. But the effort with Corning, with Dow, was a joint effort, and it did go forward. But behind the scenes, Corning then had formed Owens Corning, and the man who headed up Owens Corning was a man by the name of Bekenstein, B-O-E-S-C-H-E-N-S-T-E-I-N. And he tried to interest the Navy in electric motor insulation. Well, the real problem with the glass fibers and glass tapes that they made was that they needed a resin to impregnate this glass. And all organic resins up to that point were not as heat resistant as the glass itself. So they said, we wanted something that would go into this. And Frank's resin was that thing. However, Bekenstein tried to get the Navy interested, and he talked to Admiral, well, not Admiral, and then it was Commander, I think, Rickover. And Rick Hoover was interested when he saw Frank's tape, and as a result of his interest, the formation of Dow Corning went ahead. They held a meeting in Detroit where three people from Corning and three people from Dow went down to talk about the possibility of forming a joint venture. And they came away from that saying, yes, merely a handshake, yes, we're going to go ahead. And I think the man Beckenstein was hopeful somehow that the fiberglass company could be involved in it, but the fiberglass company was only involved during the first year or so as a sales agent for the resin because they wanted to sell tape. But from that point on, Dow Corning was formed and took over sales of its own product. But at one point, Owens Corning invited Admiral or Commander Rickover to come to Midland to see the making of this resin. And the plane was grounded in Detroit, and so we sent a car down for him. And by this time, a little bit of Dow Corning had been worked on, so we had a sales manager and a few people, but they had arranged a luncheon out here at the country club. And when they pulled up in front of the club and they were going to get out for lunch, Rickover said, no, he wasn't going to get out for lunch. He wanted to see the resin. So they had to take him out of the plant. And they had to arrange for the country club to fix up sandwiches that they could take down to the plant and eat while he saw the stuff. He just wasn't about to get out and have any fancy lunch. He wanted to get down to business. So on the way back to Detroit, they asked him, or he asked them, what they needed to make this resin. And they said magnesium and a number of other things. So he gave them the order for 25 motors and grease and paint to make the motors. And that was the priority they needed to build a plant. Because in those days, of course, it was during the war. This was summer of 42, and so we needed priorities to get anything. In fact, we couldn't get new things. There was a used property list that the Navy had, and we bought a lot of stuff off of that list for our plant. In fact, the water tower, if you happen to go by Dow Corning, the water tower there was 42 years old when we bought it in 42. It was old at the time and was put up and painted, and it's been used ever since. But there were many things like that. We couldn't get a brand new boiler and so on. But later on, of course, we did change. But nonetheless, it was a little bit of trouble to get started in those times when priorities were not obtainable and things were a little scarce. So the company was formally formed in February of 1943, and formal papers were signed and things went ahead. At that point, they had already drawn up plans for the plant on the site where it is now, and they started to build. Original authorization was for something like $740,000, and before they got finished with it, it had to be doubled, and before it was finished, it had to go up to $2,000,001 or something, because, you know, prices were going up. Things were inflating even then. And meanwhile, Willard Dow got into the picture during the formation of this company, and it appointed W.R. Collings to take over the whole project. Bill Collings had headed up the cellulose products group in Dow, and that group had its own sales, its own technical development and research and just every element, in fact, engineering group of its own and so on. It was like a small company within a company. About 75 people were involved at that time, and they had been making ethyl cellulose, and they were on their way to making methyl cell. And actually, they've been doing things like making records and the possibility of making dictation belts. That's when belts were still available and useful. Well, Collings then stepped right in, and even though Britton continued to work on the so-called hide resin, Collings and his people started to work on our so-called etherless Grignard process for making dimethyl. And they jumped right in to using a 600-gallon kettle where we'd been working with 15. And somewhat of an interesting story was we had changed the people that were involved with us on the pilot plant to the new man was John Goodwin. And he came up to show them how to run it. So here was this great big 600-gallon kettle. And he knew how difficult it was to start these Grignards. They didn't start easily. And so we had to always put warm water in the kettle and heat up the outside just to try and gently get it started. Well, he gave instructions to run warm water through the kettle, and of course they had operators to run it around the clock. And so he gave instructions. It hadn't started when he left around 9 o'clock at night, and he said, don't change it, just keep that warm water on it and keep stirring. And I guess he may have added some more methyl bromide. We used that as the charging thing, whereas methyl chloride finally was the thing that we were using. But he came in the next morning at 6 and found that the operator had cold water running in the kettle. And he said, oh, what's happened? Well, the operator said, Dr. Collings came through here and said, put cold water in. He was afraid it was getting too high a pressure. Well, a little pressure from the methyl bromide, of course, but not much. And Johnny said, but you, I told you, keep warm water on. Yeah, he said, but you, Sonny, you know what Dr. Collings does? If he told me to move that wall 6 feet, I'd move that wall 6 feet. So that was the kind of experience he had with Dr. Collings very early on. Bill Collings was a very personal leader. He did everything himself, so to speak. And he has many, many stories about him. In fact, the company just published a small booklet about him. Really, there were stories that were submitted by various people who knew him that showed various parts of his character. But he got things done, and he was the right kind of a person to run Dow Corning at a time when it was getting underway, because it needed somebody to, you know, force it through and get it going. Well, he was vice president and general manager. The president of Dow Corning was Dr. E.C. Sullivan, who was director of research and a vice president at Corning Glass. And we knew Dr. Sullivan. He was a fine gentleman, a gentleman of the old school, very definitely, and very formal, very dignified, never told jokes or anything of that sort. Everything was very serious with him. But he was the president for a number of years, and Bill Collings was vice president. So,
Sullivan was it? Was at Corning when Hyde had started his work,
right? Mm-hmm.
And you and McGregor were doing your work at Mellon. Now,
right.
In '43, let's say, when
when
the
this
Corp company was underway.
Yes.
Were you still doing your work at Mellon? And were
yes,
you,
we continued to work. Them? We continued to work at Mellon, and Hyde continued to work at Corning. In December of 43, we held our first research conference in Midland when people from Corning and people from Mellon came up. And from that point on, we held research conferences every 3 months or 4 months, something like that. Not on a real regular basis, but every so often. And this was good because it brought the groups together and had a chance to interchange information. The first one that we held, they tried to record us, our proceedings on these ethyl cellulose records, and they played them back for us, and most of us didn't recognize our voices, because somehow your voice when it records is at a lower level than you recognize it as you speak. And on one of them, it was Dr. McGregor's, it was interesting, it was a funny tick, 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 tick in the background. We couldn't understand what it was, and then all of a sudden we recognized it. He was emphasizing his points on the blackboard with a chalk. It's a very nice ticking sound in the background.
So you were coming to Midland then on a regular basis?
On a fairly regular basis. We were doing this by train in those days. We'd catch a train out of Pittsburgh and come to Detroit by morning and get off and have breakfast and get on a so-called, I've forgotten what we did call it. It was a two-car train, or maybe three-car at the most, and sometimes only one, up to Midland, and it was a slow boat, really, because it stopped everywhere. But we finally made it. And going out was the same way. I can remember first time we left, we picked up the train down behind the courthouse here and got on board, and we were in the last car, and the heat in that car was a wood stove that sat in the corner.
At the time you were doing all of this, you managed to get an SCD at the same time. Can
yes.
we talk about that for a little bit? Because
sure.
you actually did a separate thesis.
Yes.
Another kinetic study, as I recall.
Yes, another kinetic study. Yes. One thing about Mellon Institute, they allowed you to take courses outside. I took a few courses at Pitt, but finally, again, I was talking with Dr. Warner, and he said, why don't you come over here and do your work and take a thesis here? Well, I finally had to do some special, get some special arrangements so they'd allow me to do that. Normally, they didn't do that, but they finally did accept me as a graduate student on a part-time basis. And in 36, I started my thesis work at Carnegie Tech under James Fugassi. And we started out with the idea of doing a kinetic study with a lead pot as our constant temperature bath and a controller for that, which I rigged up. And I had to lay bricks. We ended up with a brick pedestal about 3 feet across, 3 feet square, and about 3 feet high, with this lead pot in the middle, surrounded by glass wool insulation and all, just to try and make a high-temperature thermostat able to run at 200 to 400 degrees centigrade. And the temperature controller was a galvanometer with a moving light beam. However, this was before the days of all the nice new controllers, and I put up one photocell so that as long as it was on that photocell, it was telling it to shut off the heat. However, if it overshot, then I was on the side where it was telling it to heat again, and so that didn't work. So we finally gave up on that as a temperature control. I worked on that for a couple of years, and we did a lot of work that Paul Fogassy was a good glass blower, so he insisted on blowing a Tepler pump, which is a pump for moving gases at low pressure, and you just raise the mercury level and it pumps the gas out, and then you lower it and it sucks the gas in and pumps it out again. Well, we went through a number of runs like that and it wasn't going to work. We just finally gave up on that one. So we went over to another system altogether, which was much more convenient, and we had a smaller thermostat and a glass system, and did work on tertiary butyl acetate as a decomposition. And I had we did this work. I did it on Saturdays and nights and Sundays. I got married in the fall of 40, and after that, Gene and I would go over on a weekend and take readings on the equipment and make runs, and I would call out the numbers and she would write them down, and we had some interesting times because we had some very fast runs that only took about a minute and a half, so it would be hard to make the readings, but nonetheless we did that. And of course during all this work, Paul Fogassy had lots of ideas, and we developed an article on the calculation of equilibria, and I had to do a lot of calculating. Well, because it was a big long formula based on infrared frequencies and energies as to which bond was going to break and so on. Well, he managed to find, and I don't know where he found it, an old brass calculator. It was a solid brass machine where you turn the crank, and I spent one whole winter turning the crank of that machine. But we got a paper out of it and published it. So in the spring or June of 43, I got my doctor's degree, but working part-time and at nights and Saturdays. Later on, John Spire, who followed me at Mellon and who was part of our group, made arrangements to use what he was doing during the day at Mellon on our work as his thesis at Pitt under Dr. Daubert. And that was fine. And it worked out beautifully. And there were others who came and did that kind of thing too, but
I was going to say, you in actuality, you did two theses at the same time. And I wondered whether the proprietary nature of the work at Mellon might have precluded you from using that.
I guess at that point I thought of that, and I was afraid they might not agree, but by the time John Spire joined us, which was in the summer of 43, and he had spent at least a year with us before he got to the point where he wanted to talk about a thesis, there was no thought that it would be too proprietary. He was doing some new things, and I guess the company was only interested in delaying publication long enough to let patents get applied.